Chapter 6. I left St. Peter's in the July of 1960. That was quite sad, but I knew it was time for me to move on. In August, my parents and I had our normal summer holiday, 10 days at a hotel in Bournemouth called the Devon Towers. And yes, that is definitely where I got the towers for my fictional hotel. I loved the Devon Towers because there was a fine full-size snooker table downstairs which no one else seemed to know about, and I could therefore monopolize it for hours at a time. I never yearned for an opponent. I was content with my own company, enjoying playing all the shots myself. That said, I was happy enough when Dad popped down to give me a game. The other main sporting entertainment in Bournemouth was the Cleese family outing to the huge ice rink in the middle of town to laugh at the beginners. Now, there's something fascinating about the nameless panic that grabs people when they are trying and failing to keep their balance, even if they only have a short distance to fall. I accept that it was mean-spirited to take such pleasure in watching the antics of these terrified creatures, but we did at least have the good manners to sit some distance from them and to try and keep our volume down. And anyway, it wasn't our fault that they were so funny. Falling over is always entertaining, but these proto-skaters were very special. Mother laughed more at them than at anything else I ever saw, and afterwards Dad and I would take her out to tea to calm her down. Back in Weston, I spent the rest of the holiday reading my way through various books that were alleged to prepare me for my legal studies. Cambridge had originally given me a place to read physics and chemistry, but I very swiftly realized that I simply wasn't interested enough to be able to compete with proper scientists. However, given my lack of other A-levels, I'd been left with a simple and stark choice between two subjects that I could start from scratch: economics and law. I decided to opt for the latter. My dad had once told me there was a tradition of law in our family, and I subsequently discovered that he was referring to his father's position as a solicitor's clerk. So now I sat down to pore over the reading list provided by the Cambridge Law School. Why Grant and Temperley's Europe in the 19th century, 1789 to 1905, was considered useful preparation for the study of trusts and settlements or Roman law, I don't know, but I dutifully ploughed through it without getting any real grasp of the reality behind the words. This is a good example of one of my worst characteristics, which is, when faced by something unfamiliar, to do exactly what I am told without applying my common sense. So here I was, about to enter one of the world's finest universities, and these were the sum of my academic accomplishments: an ability to speak and write grammatical English, and to spell well; some knowledge of maths and science, rapidly fading; an acquaintance with the dates of the kings and queens of England; a little Latin; a thin patina of geographical facts; a working knowledge of Henry V and Macbeth; and some 20 poems. No biology, psychology, economics, philosophy, political science, statistics, music, electronics, world history, art, engineering, geology, archaeology, architecture, Greek, etc., etc., etc. In a way, I was too unsophisticated to realize just how unsophisticated I was, which is why I was not consciously very anxious about leaving my life in Weston and setting off into the unknown. Nevertheless, the day I was due to take the train to Cambridge, I suffered a dreadful stomach upset and was unable to travel. What a strange coincidence. Of course, the idea of psychosomatic illness was unknown in the lower middle-class culture I inhabited, or if it was known at all in the England of that time. Cartesianism ruled on moral grounds. It was quite acceptable to have a physical illness. What was not allowed was any form of mental abnormality. This would have been seen as a sign of weakness, lack of moral fibre, and degeneracy. Ailments needed to be kept physical. The next day I felt better, and so dear old Dad drove me all the way to Cambridge, with Mum helping from the back seat. I have a clear memory of kissing them both goodbye outside Downing College, and then of turning away and walking through the gates. I knew it meant that we were finally separating, and while I was apprehensive, I also felt a sense of relief of having finally escaped from a mould. Nevertheless, I feel a deep sadness for Dad. I had been the focus of his life for so long, perhaps the main source of meaning for him, that it must have been a very painful moment for him to watch me disappear like that. Much less painful for my mother, who, after all, still had herself to think of. But then, if Dad suffered from my absence, Mum had suffered from my presence. I think their relationship had been quite a close one until I came along, but that as the rapport and warmth between Dad and me began to develop, she may have felt increasingly excluded from our intimacy and therefore from her own relationship with him. So, anyway, once inside the gates, my first impressions of Downing College were very positive. It was a friendly place, and as a first-year student, I was fortunate enough to have a room in college, a large ground-floor one near the Porter's Lodge. It also seemed easy to find out what one was supposed to do. The only shock came when I arrived rather late for dinner in hall that first evening. Grace was about to be said, so I slipped into the only vacant space I could see along the many long benches. A few words of Latin, and I sat down to find myself surrounded by chemists. So I tried chlorobenzyl acetate. No! Hoots of laughter from everyone around me. What about sodium pentothalamide? Giggles. You're not serious. If I wanted a precipitate, I would have used zinc polyclostrate. Howls of mirth, slapping of thighs, wiping of eyes, and a couple of sly glances at the tall, bearded guy in their midst, who clearly had no sense of humour. At that moment, I felt very alone. I knew Downing was the science college, but I certainly hadn't expected anything like this. I mimed that I had a hearing problem and ate my dinner quickly. The next evening proved to be momentous. Setting out early for hall to give myself a better chance of spotting chemists before it was too late, I half recognised someone who turned out to have been a fellow pupil at Clifton. Martin Davis Jones was 2 years younger than me, so at school we had only a nodding acquaintance. More than that, and the police would have intervened. But we were soon chatting away, and in turn he introduced me to his new friends, Alan Hutchison and Tony Robinson. And we sat down to dinner together. Four nice public school boys. They were more middle class than me, in sports jackets, speaking standard middle class English, and none of us chemists. We got on so well that the four of us finished up sharing digs for our last 2 years, and this transformation in my social fortunes occurred on my second day. In the interest of historical balance, I feel I should mention that Alan remembers this quite differently. He is sure that the first time he ever set eyes on me was when Martin brought him over to my room to introduce me, and that as they looked in through my ground floor window, they saw me trying to wriggle under my bed. They thought this weird, as they had no idea that I had a pet hamster. Since I'd been at Cambridge at least 2 weeks before I purchased the hamster in the street market, and I had certainly met Alan by then, I discount his version. Now I settled down to study the five subjects that made up my law degree. Two of them concerned Roman law, the idea being that we would broaden our understanding if we gained a bird's-eye view of an entire legal system. And I have to say that some of what I discovered about the Romans reflected impressively on them. It struck me, for example, that putting people guilty of parricide into a sack with a viper, a cockerel, and a dog, and then throwing them into the Tiber, seemed likely to deter others, and was certainly less expensive than imprisonment. English constitutional law I found fascinating. I was intrigued to learn how the rules for running the country had developed over the centuries, and it occurs to me now that earlier parliamentarians understood conflict of interest and the concept of checks and balances better than they do these days. International law seemed to promise a glamorous jet-set existence, especially to someone who'd not yet been outside England. And finally, there was English criminal law, which was great fun, even without the vipers. Altogether, there were about 10 lectures a week and a tutorial every fortnight in each subject when we all had to hand in an essay, so maybe 20 essays a term in all, just over a couple of weeks. This was quite manageable. The trouble was, I was conscientious. I could have arranged, around my studies, an interesting and even slightly adventurous life, but I didn't. I kick myself now when I think how other undergraduates took their Cambridge life by the scruff of its neck and spent their time doing what really mattered to them. Stephen Fry, for example, never went to a lecture. He just read and appeared in 36 plays. But I trudged off every day to attend every required lecture, at least half of which were deeply uninspiring. And I sat there dutifully taking notes, trying not to miss anything. One of our professors described a lecture as a mystical process by which the notes on the pad of the lecturer pass on to the pad of the student without passing through the mind of either. It would certainly have been so much more efficient and absorbing if our lecturers had provided full notes for us and had then discussed them. There could have been real interaction, question and answer, even argument instead of dictation. But this never happened, and my ingrained meekness meant that it took me two terms before I dared to drop even the ghastly Whaley Tooker, whose ramblings reminded me of King Lear on Valium. I also took essays far too seriously and wasted a lot of time on polishing them, though they didn't teach me much. All in all, my diligence gave me a false sense of not having much time spare to explore Cambridge life. But before I fell into this pattern of thinking, I did at least go to the Society's fair, which was held at the Corn Market building on the first weekend of term. I was astonished at the variety of activities on offer. There was a multitude of stands manned by keen young undergraduates, all trying to persuade you to sign up for potholing, bridge, bell ringing, drama, the young Christians, skydiving, brass rubbing, water sports, paranormal studies, martial arts, the union, photography, the Marxist-Leninists, taxidermy. As I drifted around, feeling slightly overwhelmed and not at all bold, I had at the back of my mind, and really quite a long way back, the word footlights. Not that I had any idea of what that meant. It was just that when I'd done various entertainments at Clifton, a couple of masters had said, "So, when you get to Cambridge, you'll be joining the footlights then." And I knew, therefore, it must be something to do with humour. Nevertheless, when I spotted the footlights stand and a couple of friendly fellows sitting there, smiling invitingly, it took me some time to wrestle down a strong sense of impending embarrassment. That done, I pretended I had suddenly seen the stand and strolled over, smiled as best I could, and said, "Ah, hello, the footlights. I was wondering if I might possibly be interested in..." "Of course," one of them cried, handing me a leaflet. "Do you sing?" "Sing?" I thought, "What are they talking about? Sing? No, I don't sing. I'm the worst singer in the world. Mr. Hickley had me removed from singing classes at school because I was so bloody terrible. There is nothing that I do worse. Why in the bowels of Christ are they asking me if I sing? What on earth has that got to do with being funny?" "Not really," I responded. "Never mind," said the other footlights representative. "Do you dance?" "Dance!" My head began to swim. "Yes, yes, dance," he repeated. "No," I said, "if I wanted to dance, I'd probably be standing at the classical ballet stand or the modern dance stand or the ballroom dancing stand or the tap dancing stand or the Morris dancing stand or the dancing for chemists stand.
All right, I didn't say this. What I actually said was, no, I'm not very good at dancing. Sorry. They nodded kindly. So, what do you do?
Embarrassment, confusion, humiliation, indignation all welled up.
I try to make people laugh,
I blurted out, and I ran for it. And that was the end of my show business career. As far as I knew. Or cared. It may seem odd, but the whole grisly episode soon faded from my memory. I had no sense that I'd missed out on something important or that some talent lurking within me was yearning for expression. After all, I was going to be a lawyer. Apparently, though I couldn't remember exactly how the decision had been taken. Law, then, had to come first, and law seemed to be a lot about arguing, about putting your case or dismantling someone else's. So maybe learning to debate would help me. Accordingly, I went along to the Cambridge Union to see a debate from the balcony and watched as a series of very young men, aged between 19 and 22, stood up and pretended to be 55. They all wore suits with waistcoats, they all tucked their thumbs into their waistcoat pockets, and they all spoke a weird, oratorical, bombastic language that was utterly unlike normal speech. Clearly, they were trying to create the impression of being promising politicians, yet they had no idea how ridiculous they seemed. They were all behaving in the same manner when, to the rest of us, they were so obviously inflated, self-satisfied, slow-witted duds. The gap between the impression they were trying to create and the way that their fellow students actually viewed them was truly extraordinary. It would have been even more astounding had I known then that several of these fatheads would finish up in John Major's cabinet. I'll say it again. The very group that was most disliked and belittled at Cambridge in the early 60s was running the country 30 years later, or sort of running it. So, since the Cambridge Union was rubbish, what else was there? Well, the one activity that my consciousness had been shaped to accept was sport. So I signed up to play college soccer, took part in a trial game, made a small impression. As it happens, I wasn't bad at soccer. I had good control, I could trick an opponent, and sometimes thread a nice pass. Playing inside left, I even created the occasional goal. The trouble was that I was far too tall, embarrassingly skinny, a bit slow on the turn, physically quite weak, nowhere fit enough, and I couldn't shoot. Despite these handicaps, though, I was just good enough to get a place in the team, and so became one of two Southerners in the Downing 11. A Southerner was defined at Downing as someone born south of the River Trent, and I was regarded by the rest of the team with tolerant affection as posh. This was quite a surprise for an insurance salesman's son, and I wasn't quite sure how to react. You see, in the early 60s, Britain was so ridden with class distinction that it coloured every aspect of life, though generally in an unspoken way. 10 years later, when we were making Monty Python, we all assumed that the whole system was on its way out, that it was fading away. But the fact that it's still alive and well today suggests we were quite deluded. Take money, for example. In the 60s, money was, well, vulgar. At least to talk about it was vulgar, and any blatant attempt to acquire large quantities of it was crude and aesthetically offensive. My friend Tony Jay once summed it up. It was all right to have money, it was just getting it that was vulgar. It's also almost impossible to convey the attitude then to the world of business. Businessmen, there weren't many business women, were regarded as peripheral, half-educated creatures whose academic failures had forced them to earn a living in the dull, second-rate world of commerce. Interesting, nobody resented their making piles of money because it was felt that this was the one compensation the world offered them for undertaking such stultifying activities. In my entire 3 years at Cambridge, I met only one undergraduate who intended to enter the world of business. He was going to go into soap powder so that he could retire at 40. It was fascinating to see how the aristocratic attitude to trade had infected the public schools and even brainwashed little plebeian gits like me. What did matter at Cambridge was professional reputation. There were the grand jobs like being a surgeon or a barrister or a professor, and there were the more mundane occupations like being a solicitor or an accountant or a general practitioner. The aim in life was to become very good at whichever category of job you went for, and to earn the respect of your colleagues and enough money to lead a very comfortable life. It was also vital to have a few cultural interests outside your work. The aim was to be well-rounded, educated, accomplished, well-informed, and comfortably off. My position in all this was a delicately poised one. I knew that the real toffs would never accept me as a kosher English gentleman, but because my parents had spent their savings on sending me to Clifton, I was at least able to pass myself off as middle class if I wanted to, which I eventually did all the time in the roles I was acting. Casting agents never thought of me as Mexican bandit chief material, nor did cheerful Cockney or Slovenian hitman roles come my way. No, only the respectable and even slightly grand professionals. If I wanted to play anything else, I had to write it myself. And I could see no harm in trying to turn myself into a fake English gentleman because I had incorporated my father's view of gentlemanly behaviour. I remember being told stories about guests at royal banquets who'd picked up the wrong fork, whereupon the king had done likewise to avoid embarrassing them, and all the other guests had followed suit. And I was touched by this. It was nothing to do with snobbery. I read once that the journalist Auberon Waugh reproached a guest who had taken off his jacket and put it on the back of his chair, telling him it was not gentlemanly. I thought it was not gentlemanly to have pointed this out. I saw little friction between the classes at Cambridge. I met very few of the upper classes, but when I did, I realised how different their lives were. They genuinely liked chasing things and shooting them and hooking them out of the water and asphyxiating them. Death seemed to be the inevitable result of all their entertainments, despite their excellent manners. The working-class students, they were more students than undergraduates, seemed by contrast a little less outgoing and took work much more seriously than my upper-middle-class friends. Few, if any of them, regarded university as any kind of finishing school. The scientists were especially formidable in this regard, preferring their chemistry labs to ordinary habitations. And if the average public schoolboy was not a natural dancer, the chemists were unnatural dancers. They looked as though they had borrowed their bodies for the weekend and had not yet figured out how to work them. One tall, red-haired chemist with half-mast trousers moved like a Bournemouth proto-skater, even when he was just crossing the quad. Alan, Martin and I would watch out for him and were once treated to the sight of him completely losing the knack of walking and falling in a heap on the ground. The only awkwardness that existed between the classes seemed to be between the public schoolboys and the grammar schoolboys. The latter were just as bright, but the fact that their parents had not had to pay school fees drew attention to the fact that they came from less affluent homes, and they could seem a little ill at ease socially. As I got to know them, they all told me the same thing, that most public school boys had a confidence that they felt they lacked, and so in social situations they often felt ill at ease. They wondered how the public school chaps had acquired their sense of self-assurance, and I certainly couldn't tell them. I guess that some people took their position in the social hierarchy so seriously it made them feel superior and act accordingly. Since most of the really confident people I met were actually rather stupid, it was very easy for them to think that it was class rather than intelligence that mattered. Self-confidence seemed to be more mimicry than anything else, and I suggested visiting Clifton Zoo to watch the leaders in a group of baboons and learn from them. Make your gestures slow and deliberate. Cultivate a deeper voice, appear casual at all times, eschew all rapid movements. That was all you had to do to look confident. I also knew that I could do confident, and it helped enormously socially that I appeared to be able to fake it, no matter how insecure, anxious, or inferior I actually felt. And I did feel insecure. It was the Bartlett effect, the sense that I should be formidably well-informed about everything, when in reality I was quite ignorant. And since I believed that knowing lots of facts was a sign of superior intelligence, my life was one long struggle to suggest subtly that I knew a lot. And then, after just a few weeks, I had an epiphany. I was talking to a very well-informed fellow called Peregrine something or other, and nodding knowledgeably and smiling wryly at I knew not what, when on an impulse I suddenly said, "I don't know about that. Will you tell me about it?" There was a moment of silence, but the ceiling did not fall in. Peregrine something or other did not slap me contemptuously with the back of his hand or spit in my face. Instead, he visibly brightened and proceeded to give me a thoroughly good explanation of what he'd been talking about. He enjoyed explaining it, and I enjoyed understanding it, and he clearly liked me better for having given him the opportunity to display his learning. Instead of humiliation, then, I had initiated a profitable transaction. It was a revelation, and I found it such a liberation and such a relief to be able to abandon that phony, omniscient posture. The other main cause of my social insecurity, my painful inability to talk to women as though they were from the same planet, lay a little ahead, since I was seldom within earshot of anything female in my law lectures. There were, in fact, just 3 women in amongst 200 men, and overall 18 all-male colleges to set along the all-female Girton and Newnham. So my social life was very uneventful. The odd curry, the occasional film, regular coffee with a few friends, and now and again a party. At one of these, I got drunk for the first time. My old Clifton friend, Adrian Upton, asked me over to his birthday party and met me with a challenge to down a glass of Yugoslavian Riesling in one go, which I did, thinking myself dead cool. Some 15 minutes later, he repeated the challenge. Down the hatch, and soon I was feeling unaccountably happy, and then a little dizzy, but even happier, for Adrian had spiked my drinks. 2/3 of each glass of Riesling had been gin. God now provided some cabaret. The son of the Secretary General of the United Nations started quarrelling with Adrian, and blows began to fly, but not to land, because Adrian and he were standing so far apart that contact was made only when, in the course of frantically windmilling at each other, their knuckles occasionally brushed. It was wonderful. The sight of such frenzied aggression producing such tiny results struck me as epoch-shatteringly funny. Add to this the fact that one combatant was the son of the man who, above all others, was trying to reduce the amount of fighting in the world, and the punch-up seemed to have all the appearance of a divinely scripted farce. I laughed so much I made a spectacle of myself, and this annoyed the combatants, and the speed of their windmilling became even more frantic and funnier, at which point the room began to revolve, nausea, panic, and regret took over, and I was forced to focus on survival. I have never got really drunk since. My Cambridge life now settled into a routine, and I became rather a dull fellow. Martin Davis Jones always said he thought of me as odd. Well, I was 6'4" tall, extremely thin and bearded, so I certainly looked odd. And I had a hamster, which was unusual, and a strange wheezing laugh, and I spent a lot of time in my own company and the hamsters. But odd? No. Dull. Then, in an attempt to lighten me up, fate intervened. Alan Hutchison happened to bump into an old friend from Radley College who was on the Footlights Committee. He asked Alan if he was interested in such things, and Alan said he wasn't particularly, but he had a friend who'd done shows at school, and Somehow, Alan and I finished up in the Footlights Club room chatting with this guy. This time there was no mention of singing or dancing. From our point of view, the main attraction at the Footlights was the club room itself. It was relaxed and comfortable with a tiny bar and some lunch tables and sofas, and at one end a small permanent stage with curtains and lights. But what really excited us was that it was plumb in the middle of Cambridge, the perfect place to pass time between lectures or to grab a quick and incredibly cheap lunch. To gain membership, one had to do an audition piece at one of the smoking concerts that were produced every month by a couple of the senior members. These were very friendly events for the simple reason that because every member of the audience was expected to do a turn at some point in the evening, it was in everybody's interest to keep the atmosphere jolly and encouraging. So Alan and I trudged back to Downing and sat down to figure out an audition piece. After discarding several ideas, we hit on the notion of doing a mock television news broadcast. 50 years later, a more hackneyed and overdone format could not be imagined, but in early 1961, it was quite unusual. Now, to understand how this could conceivably be the case, you have to grasp just how deferential, stuffy, compulsively super polite, and excruciatingly cautious British culture was at that time. I can recall a brief TV interview from the late 50s when a journalist, asking the Chancellor of the Exchequer about the budget that he was about to present, came up with the following convolutedly polite question. I wonder, sir, if you would be prepared to say a few words about what you are about to reveal to the House of Commons. It was like a head boy at a major public school doing a pretend spontaneous interview with his headmaster. This reverential attitude towards authority extended to the BBC itself, where seriousness of purpose easily toppled into pomposity. So, for us to send up the evening news was ever so slightly daring. Drawing on the fact that the newsreaders at that time read the news from sheets of paper rather than from any form of prompter, the first thing Alan and I wrote went as follows. A newsreader speaks. Good evening. Here is the news. The newsreader stops and peers at the sheet of paper. I'm sorry, here are the news. The Queen. The newsreader now smiles beatifically and lays that sheet of paper reverentially aside and turns to the next sheet. And Prince Philip. The newsreader gives another ethereal smile. Together visited Balmoral and... I remember that we included a few topical items, one of them inspired by the news that General de Gaulle had just blocked Britain's entry into the common market. The newsreader says, at a moving mid-channel ceremony, the traditional Anglo-French entente cordiale was rekindled when President de Gaulle and British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan opened the escalators connecting the French Channel Bridge to the English Channel Tunnel. Transplants were also in the news. Mr. Gerald Dawkins, who in a major transplant operation last year received the heart, liver, lungs, and spleen of a pig, is now completely recovered. He is back to his former weight of 11 stone. He takes 2 brisk walks a day and costs 8 shillings a pound. Then there was a long final item about a Cornish mine disaster, sending up the serious tone that the BBC adopted when tragedy was in the air. This evening, prospects of a successful rescue are rapidly diminishing. Nevertheless, while any hope remains, operations are being continued by floodlight. Betsy, the 8-year-old collie, belonging to the Clark family of Mabshurst in Cornwall, who has been trapped on a ledge 120 feet down a disused tin mine, is weakening, despite quantities of brandy and rabbit lowered to her. Earlier, Mr. Clark and his son Ronald tragically fell to their deaths during their descent to rescue the dog when within barking distance of it.
Julia, Mr. Clark's teenage daughter, then descended and actually reached the ledge, but fell to her death when bitten by the dog. Mrs. Clark, 39, the one surviving member of the family, said before attempting the perilous descent later this evening, "Inhuman people will say this is madness, but I know it is what my husband would have wished." This was about as far as satire went in early 1961. Alan was to play the newsreader, so I needed my own piece to perform, and I decided to use a monologue I had written when I was still at school. I'd stolen the idea for it from a television performer called Professor Stanley Unwin, who managed to talk complete nonsense that somehow sounded just like English. The first time I heard him, I became so hysterical with mirth that I frightened my parents. Further exposure to Unwin's gibberish had the same alarming effect. I had a similar reaction when I first heard Charlie Chaplin's fake German in The Great Dictator. I didn't understand why this kind of nonsense so convulsed me, but I watched Unwin obsessively and slowly figured out how he did it, which was to take certain syllables from very ordinary words and mix them up with syllables from other equally common words so that the sounds were totally familiar English ones, but the overall effect quite meaningless. His version of Goldilocks and the Three Bears, for example, began, "Once Hippolyto and Goldilocks sent out in the deep dark of the forest. She was carrying a basket with buttery flavour and cheesy flavour." I have at times suspected that what I seem to laugh at most are the things that frighten me. I find anger, like Basil Fawlty's, hilarious, provided it is ineffectual, as real anger might be too disturbing. I'm terrified of violence, yet I shout with laughter at great slapstick comedy that threatens people's physical safety. Think of Harold Lloyd or Chaplin, or of Eddie Murphy crossing the freeway in Steve Martin's Bowfinger. My sense of humour has been described as cruel, mainly by BBC executives, yet I am almost obsessively appalled by torture, and I howl at absurdity and nonsense when my deepest psychic fear is a sense of meaninglessness. Am I trying to diminish a fear by laughing at it and thereby belittling it, reducing its threat? So, anyway, once I'd worked out how Stanley Unwin produced his strangely convincing gobbledygook, it was easy to scribble out another example for the Footlights audition. Of course, it was an absolute bugger to learn, but I decided to present the piece as a scientific lecture, which allowed me to glance at my notes whenever I thought I was about to panic. The show we were auditioning for was being produced by two experienced third-year Footlighters, and they encouraged me to do another idea, which I'd stolen from a BBC radio show. It was a parody of the last 2 minutes of a typical BBC detective thriller, when all the suspects gather together and the detective explains the whole plot. The idea that I pinched was that in order to make the plot exposition less boring, the detective delivered it during a final hand-to-hand combat with the villain, who himself added plot clarifications at appropriate moments between punches. The dialogue was easy to reproduce. "Inspector, so when Henderson went to the antique shop to get the map from Colonel Harding, whack, oh, he happened to see Lady Pendleton emerging from the Chinese laundry. Take that, splat." Villain, "Exactly, Inspector, so Henderson thought, whack." I managed to persuade Adrian Upton, fresh from his recent combat, the son of the Secretary-General of the United Nations, to perform the fight with me, which involved much enjoyable rehearsal, and on the night of the performance all three sketches went well, and the three of us were elected members of the Footlights. If it seems that I have taken an age to relate to you some trivial auditionings for a mere Footlight smoker, it's because all three sketches turned out to have an unexpected afterlife. The newsreading sketch was performed later that year in the annual Footlights Review, and then again on That Was the Week That Was, when David Frost read it as the final item in the last show of the first series. The Stanley Unwin rip-off
had become a standard part of my cabaret routine, last performed on my one-man show UK tour in 2011, 50 years after its first appearance in the Footlights Clubroom. And the plot explication fight appeared in the 1962 Footlights Review, the first in which I performed, and then on That Was the Week That Was, and then rewritten and expanded in the 1963 Footlights Review, which played in the West End for 5 months and finished up on Broadway in 1964. However, if you think my first smoker appearances seemed to bode well, they didn't. My next few suggestions were so feeble they were turned down, and the couple that were accepted for performance only just avoided being embarrassing. This was probably because I was trying to think up funny ideas of my own, instead of stealing a good one from writers who knew what they were doing. The fact is that it is exceedingly difficult to write really good comedy, and those who could do it possess a very rare talent. Of course, there are a few writers around who can think up decent jokes, a few more could do parody well, but the number who can invent an original comedy situation and build that situation in a convincing but unpredictable way, and above all, get the emotional development of the characters right, is infinitesimally small. On the other hand, there exist vast hordes who can write bad comedy, and they do so in immense quantities, entirely uninhibited by any awareness of just how atrocious it is. At the beginning of my career, I often used to read scripts that I'd been sent by unknown writers, and it seemed to take me about 20 years before I realized that they were all, always, awful. So I give the following advice to any young writer who, despite the odds, wants to take a shot at being funny. It is this. Steal. Steal an idea that you know is good and try to reproduce it in a setting that you know and understand. It will become sufficiently different from the original because you are writing it, and by basing it on something good, you will be learning some of the rules of good writing as you go along. Great artists are said to be influenced by other artists, but comics steal and then conceal their loot. Still, even if I couldn't come up with any decent ideas in the early days, I could at least use the Footlights Clubroom, and what a delight that was. I found there the nicest bunch of fellows I'd ever come across. Friendly, funny, good-natured, from a wide mix of subjects, bright without being show-offs, a complete contrast to the occasional group of actors who would from time to time infiltrate the club. Invariably dressed in black leather jackets and jeans, the actors would gather around a table and sit, leaning forward, carrying on intense soul-searching discussions about motivation or alienation, which made me anxious because I didn't know what those words meant and felt rather rattled by the sheer intensity of it all. Looking back, I now see why the actors were so different. It was because they all intended to become professionals. The Footlights chaps, by contrast, had no intention at all of making careers in the chancy world of show business. They were all headed for the law, medicine, teaching, advertising, and they took part in Footlights activities for the sheer fun of it. Well, in 1961, anyway. Within 5 years, all that had changed. Because the 1963 Cambridge Circus was so successful, and every member of the London cast became part of the profession, students started coming to Cambridge with the specific intent of using the Footlights as a gateway to the wonderful world of light entertainment. So anyway, I was far more concerned about the exams that I was to take in June. This was no doubt in part because I had no sense of what level of knowledge was expected by the examiners, and this gave rise to a lurking sense of panic. My worry about whether I was doing enough work was neatly summed up by a cartoon in a Cambridge magazine showing two undergraduates sunbathing by the River Cam. One is saying, "If only we'd done some work in the winter, there wouldn't be this mad panic now." In my case, the anxiety increased, but my hours of study didn't. As I panicked, a letter arrived inviting me to audition for the 1961 Footlights Review. I was initially quite excited until I realized that this was a mere formality extended to every Footlights member. I turned up at the Arts Theatre, nevertheless, only to be asked to sing Mama's Little Baby Loves Shortenbread and to dance the cha-cha-cha. A sickening sense of déjà vu descended on me. I felt like those poor French infantrymen in the First World War who went over the top and ran towards the German machine guns, bleating like sheep. Fortunately, it was all over in a few seconds. But there was an unexpected award for my humiliation, because as I stood after coming off stage in a state of shock, a tall chap waiting in the queue for his punishment offered a few words of consolation, and then minutes later I was having coffee with my main writing partner for the next 20 years. My first impression of Graham Chapman was of physical strength. He was slightly shorter than me, but much tougher in the lean, angular way of a sportsman. He did not surprise me when he said he was a medical student who climbed mountains and played rugby football. He was wearing a rather hairy tweed jacket and heavy brogues, and he soon lit up a pipe. He seemed dead butch and slightly taciturn. We chatted for a time, had a couple of laughs, and then we drifted on our way. The only clear memory I have is that I didn't really connect with him and consequently didn't feel I particularly liked him. Exam panic now peaked. One evening I was looking so depressed that Martin Davies-Jones picked up the old-fashioned gas ring on which we could boil a saucepan and offered it to me. I didn't even smile. In the event, though, my fears turned out to have been misplaced, the exam papers were not bad, and all the worrying proved to have been a waste of time. The problem was that I carried around with me a tendency to feel that other people's respect for me would vanish if what I did was in any way second rate. And while I accept that this perfectionism is likely to stimulate the production of better work, it doesn't, unfortunately, go hand in hand with a relaxed and happy attitude to life. This is especially the case in comedy, because if you're trying to make people laugh and failing, it is so intensely embarrassing. There is no escape. As my daughter Camilla once said, being a comedian has a lot in common with being a matador. The feedback is so instant, you can't argue about it. After the exams, I went to see the Footlights Review that I'd auditioned for. I was impressed by the professional sheen of its presentation, and I liked the individual performers. David Frost, in particular, stood out, and I felt a thrill when he read out some of our news items, the Cornish mining disaster going particularly well. I had occasionally seen David in the clubroom. He was obviously a big star in university circles, and I'd been very impressed by his friendliness towards us small fry. It's strange to think he would become the single strongest force shaping my career. At the end of my first year, I headed back to St. Peter's to help Mr. Tolson out with a medium-sized teaching emergency. Apparently, a teacher had resigned rather suddenly, and the school needed someone to fill in for the last 6 weeks of term. From my point of view, the timing was perfect. When I arrived back at St. Peter's, I was touched by the warmth of my reception by the Tolsons and the staff with whom I'd been teaching just a year before. After dinner, Mr. Tolson took me into his study and invited me to sit down. Then he slumped in his chair and revealed the circumstances of the emergency that had necessitated my recall. Apparently, he explained, before the summer term had started, he needed to find a new teacher, and having interviewed several applicants, had opted for one with particularly good qualifications. After a few days, though, it became clear that this new teacher was a bit odd. He wore strange, almost inexplicable pieces of clothing. He revealed startling areas of ignorance. He occasionally let out disagreeing sounds during church service. And what seemed to worry Mr. Tolson most, he insisted on holding a 6-foot piece of bamboo while umpiring cricket matches. Everyone had tried to be tolerant, but there had been unease. Then, one night, Mr. Tolson was woken by shouting. Two men had gained entrance to the school grounds, two very angry men who alleged that the teacher had been getting up to no good in the local town and that their sons had been involved in this unsavoury activity. There was a public fuss, and the name of St. Peter's School was mentioned. Mr. Tolson felt that he'd been guilty of grave professional misconduct. I liked Mr. Tolson so much. He was such a decent man that I tried to defend him. "But, sir," I said, "you said he had excellent qualifications." Mr. Tolson looked at me. "I never bothered to check them, John. You see, when he came for his interview, he was wearing an MCC tie. I nearly laughed out loud, but then I felt sad for him. His deference to a much-hallowed institution, the home of English cricket, had let him down so badly. He was devastated. The rest of the term, however, passed off pleasantly, and a few weeks later I left St. Peter's for the third and last time. I used to think that the world was basically sane, with patches of madness here and there which could recede as rationality and good jokes push their boundaries ever inwards. Now I have the opposite view entirely. But one of the patches of sanity that I treasure is my memory of St. Peter's, where people seem to be doing a useful job in a conscientious way, where money seemed quite secondary, and learning good manners and good sportsmanship were the values that guided its inhabitants. It was, as Mr. Bartlett would have said, highly civilized.